This episode of Atomic Moms is brought to you by Seedling. Seedling's mission is to create play experiences that feed a child's curious spirit. This holiday, go to seedling.com and use the code ATOMIC. You'll get $10 off a $30 order. Go get creative gifts for every kid on your list. It's time to play. Welcome to Atomic Moms, a modern parenting podcast about the joys and complexities of caring for our children and ourselves. I'm Ellie Noss, and each week we celebrate and commiserate with best-selling authors, parenting experts, and moms around the world.
It's so easy to move into those angry, punishing, scary ways that I was certainly raised that way. Fear and shame does not inspire good decisions later in life. In the short term, it may make them toe the line, but as soon as they reach adolescence and into adulthood, that will lead them to make the worst choices possible, not only ones that put their lives at risk, but put their hearts at risk.
Hey, everybody, subscribe on iTunes, itunes.com/atomicmoms. Woohoo! Today, we have a very, very special interview. It is with Dr. Laura Berman. She has written many books, but today we will be talking to her about quantum love. Use your body's atomic energy to create the relationship you desire. And because she is such a BFD, she's such a big deal, I'm going to ask Bridget now to read her long bio.
Okay. Laura Berman, PhD, is a world-renowned sex and relationship educator and therapist, popular TV, radio, and internet host, New York Times best-selling author, and assistant clinical professor of OBGYN and psychiatry at the Feinberg School of Medicine at Northwestern University in Chicago. Side note, that's where I went. Go Cats. Oh, I went. Okay. Considered a thought leader in her field, Dr. Berman has helped countless couples build stronger relationships, improve their sex lives, and achieve a heightened level of intimacy through her TV and radio shows, books, columns, and website, along with her private practice based in Chicago. Dr. Berman is a New York Times bestselling author of many books on sexual health and pleasure, a weekly columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times, and host of the radio program Uncovered with Dr. Laura Berman. She's appeared on Fox News, CNN, and The Today Show, as well as the New York Times, USA Today, and every major woman's magazine.
And Atomic Moms.
And Atomic Moms. Dr. Berman serves on the advisory board for The Dr. Oz Show and is a regular guest on The Steve Harvey Show.
So there's that.
Yeah. She was also Oprah's relationship expert.
Yes.
For the run of her show.
And we're big fans. This book is amazing. I can't wait for you guys to read it. I listened to it on Audible, and I actually had it at a speed of like 1.5 and occasionally a speed of 2, which I would not recommend, although it did make me run faster on the treadmill.
Very motivated.
But I am
harnessed your body's atomic energy.
I did, yeah. Exactly. I'm already finding her tools so helpful. She talks about how she, in the book, she talks about how she had a client who couldn't stand her stepson, like just hated his guts. And Dr. Berman asked her to keep a journal where she would just list 5 things that she liked about her stepson. And at first it was hard for the stepmom to do this, but she committed to it. And then it was amazing how their relationship shifted because of just being able to recognize the good in someone else and putting your attention on that rather than on everything that bugs you. And she also talks about having a 30-second hug with your partner. So I did that. Adam came home last night, and I, gave him this big hug, and I, wouldn't let go. And it was awkward for a moment, but then he melted into it. And it was so sweet. And so she has all these really practical tools along with this huge idea that, you know, we're all energy and that our feelings are energy and that we're all connected and – you know, not only is this helpful in our love life, but also in our love lives with our children. That wasn't creepy the way I just said that, was it?
Mm-mm.
I have a love life with Sabrina.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sometimes I call my daughter my tiny girlfriend, but I don't mean it romantically.
How are you feeling, Bridget?
I'm good. You mean, I don't think I've said on here that
no,
I'm pregnant.
No, let's announce it.
I'm almost 30. Well, let's see. It's after Thanksgiving here. So I'm 32 weeks pregnant. And I'm having a boy this time at the end of January. So I'm feeling pretty good. This one has been harder than the first pregnancy. Nothing major, thank goodness. But just, as my sister said, more hassles.
Yeah? Like what? Just doctor's appointments?
I had morning sickness this time. I've had chronic nosebleeds, which is an unfortunate but turns out not uncommon pregnancy.
It's really embarrassing to imagine a pregnant woman running to the bathroom because there's blood coming out of
it. It's very gory. Luckily, they've almost all been in the early morning. They've woken me up. But it's very strange. I was not a nosebleedy kid, so it's like extra weird.
Adam gets them, and I'm so turned off by it.
It's very yucky. That's how you know I spend a lot of time with an almost three-year-old. But Ali Wong, the comedian, who's very funny, when she gets excited, she gets them. Which I read in the New Yorker profile. I was like, well, that's much worse. So, like, any kind of excitement. But yeah, I'm excited. I'm not having a nosebleed because I'm excited, but I'm excited. I'm feeling pretty good. My face is already filled out.
It hasn't. You cannot tell you're pregnant.
No one knows.
I'll take a picture of us. You can't tell, except for your cute belly.
I have a giant stomach. I have a hernia, but everything's fine. You know, he's great. Yeah. So far, so that's good.
I think it's interesting that you have morning sickness because isn't it usually supposed to be a girl thing?
Yeah, but this is supposedly. But I didn't have any with my daughter and I've had it this time. And this is also like people who are like, oh, you know, the old wives' tales, like, oh, you look the same. It must be a boy, which before people would be like, oh, the way you're carrying, it's a boy. And I was like, no, it's a girl. You know, same thing. So people just have their theories.
People are full of theories.
And I'm like, gender's a construct, you guys.
Yeah, totally.
But I mean, he does have male sex organs. So I'm calling him a boy. He's a boy.
Okay. So I guess let's call Dr. Berman.
Yeah. Let's do it in Chi-Town.
We'll be right back. I just want to say thank you so much for writing this book. I'm kind of super aggravated with you that you didn't write it 10 years ago because
why?
I spent about a decade trying to figure this out for myself. And and now I'm just going to give everyone this book.
Good.
I mean, will you first of all tell us a little bit about it and, you know, the personal experiences that led to you writing it?
Sure. This book, you know, I've written eight books. This one by far is my favorite, and it's not one that I ever imagined in a million years, 15 years ago, I would write. And a lot of people thought I was crazy in my family, and, you know, they're like, you're writing about what? The truth is, so Quantum Love is the title of the book, and it's a very personal book for me because it was inspired not only by my work, which is, you know, as a sex, love, and relationship therapist for the past 25 years, but which is the place from which all my other books were written. This was really written from my life as well, because what happened is I went through a series of what I like to call AFGEs, another freak and growth experience after another. You know how we have those, some people call it dark night of the soul. Some people call it a crisis. You know,
You had three big ones.
Yeah, I had a lot going on. And the main issues, the main ones were my mother died relatively suddenly, pretty suddenly. I know it's always hard for a mother to die, but she was like my soul twin and we were extremely close and connected and it was devastating to me to lose her. And then, within a year she died of cancer, of breast cancer, and that came back. And then within a year, I died. Gosh, that's a Freudian slip, right? I guess a part of me did die and was reborn.
Yeah.
Within a year, I had breast cancer in the same breast she had it in.
Wow.
And then I also had to just stop my life as a result of that. Because what it turned out that I had this really unusual and very aggressive situation because my cancer was HER2 positive, which is a very aggressive kind of cancer, and it requires a certain kind of protein. You know, 7 years ago, if you had this, you were basically a goner, but now, thank goodness, they have treatment for it. But it was weird to see in a woman with my medical history and without the other risk factors that, you know, that I was missing. So I really had to stop my life to figure all of that out and to go through the treatment. And around the same time, just coincidentally, or the universe having my back, my projects that I was doing with Oprah. At the time, I was doing her show regularly as her sex and love expert, and that her show came to an end around the same time. My radio show that I've been doing for 3 years on her XM Sirius radio station came to an end as well, as they were kind of deciding what they were going to do next in OWN and everything else. And so everything just sort of stopped in my life. And my family started to really unravel, especially my kids, in the wake of not only their grandmother dying, but now me having the same kind of cancer. And so they were all going through their own traumas and tribulations and acting out and difficulties in school. So,
and I'm sure also with your son had childhood leukemia. So all of that must have come back visiting the hospital.
He was totally post-traumatic stress. Yeah. You know, he was definitely, and he was already going through a hard time in general with some of the long-term neurologic side effects, which they now understand a lot more about from the cancer treatment that he had as such a young child. So there was a lot going on in my house, and I really felt helpless. All my usual tools and tricks, you know, taking them to the shrink, you know, doing my usual behavioral modification, you know, all the things that you guys talk about, I'm sure, you know, on the parenting techniques and the tools. And, you know, here I am as a therapist, and I'd always been able to manage all this stuff, and nothing was working. And so because of that, I had to start looking more deeply. And also, I had the time to look more deeply. So thanks to that, those AFTEs, I really ended up stumbling upon a path that I never imagined. And that's what led me to Quantum Love, which is basically this amazing ability that we all have to use our body's energy to create the relationships and the reality we desire. And so as I was digging around, and I came back to the law of attraction and The Secret, which I'd read many, many years prior, I really started to question it, like, how does this really work? And I started to do more and more research, and I discovered some of the research that was going on in quantum physics that really is the science behind the law of attraction. And there's real science there that it's fascinating. And that captured my imagination. And as I started to try to create techniques using this new knowledge to address the issues within my own family, I was really amazed at how well it worked. And then I started, once I got back to work and started seeing patients again, I started practicing and teaching it with my clients, and then was amazed at how well that was working. And so that's when I knew I was onto something, and that's what led to Quantum Love.
We talk on the show about energy a lot, and this idea, especially with sleep training our children, that, you know, that the energy that we are not separated by a door. So when our daughter's crying, if we're we have had the expert Jennifer Waldberger on, and she basically says, you know, if you are able to calm yourself, if you are able to energetically center yourself, be grounded, that that can only help your child calm down. And that she's had experiences where a mother, the second, you know, the door is shut, the baby's crying, and if the mother can sit there and quietly just send love to her baby, that the baby will quiet. And it's, it's amazing, especially with our children. Just, it's proof to me that this is true. I mean, my husband jokes with me about, like, he's like, I don't believe in energy. And I'm like, well, I don't even know how to deal with you.
You're like, let me tell you how you're making me feel right now.
Exactly. This is affecting
my
energy.
My husband, I call center root chakra, because he's so pragmatic and everything is evidence-based, and he doubts everything. But he's totally become a believer because he's seen what I can do, and he knows that I do it to him sometimes. And I do it, you know, it's like a Jedi mind trick for your relationship. But basically what you're talking about is, from a quantum physics standpoint, is what they call quantum entanglement or entrainment. Because the truth is, when those people with whom we have that very close connection, our loved ones, our partners, our children, we are quantumly entangled. Our atoms are entangled together. So we're all made at our core. We are all just pure energy, atomic energy. We're atoms, right? Our atoms are vibrating. That's really what we really are. And And what happens when two atoms are entangled, like let's just say we were looking at the two atoms, they're spinning at exactly the same rate, speed, angle, everything. And if I were to take one of those atoms and go to China with it and start spinning it in the opposite direction, the one back here with you would start spinning in the opposite direction at the same moment. Because once you're entangled, you remain that way no matter how far apart you are. And what we found is that this happens. We're all like human tuning forks. You know how you strike one tuning fork and the other tuning fork matches it. We are always matching each other's energy unconsciously. And it really made sense to me when I looked at some of the neurologic research out there and understand, you know, how, I was trying to understand how come all of this is happening beyond our conscious awareness and what I, for most of us. And what I learned is that we take in 40 billion bits of information every millisecond into our brains, but we only consciously process 2,000 of them. So there's this whole communication going on beyond our awareness that we can't necessarily tune into until we start to discover these things and use them intentionally. Because what typically happens, women already know this, moms certainly know this. I mean, the second a kid gets in my car, I know how their day went. I know how they feel. I know if they're upset, not even looking at their face, I can just feel it. You know, or when you come into the house and you know your partner's in a bad mood, like they're, women especially are very good at this because, and mothers even more, because going through the gestation and birthing process, certainly, but even just nursing, nurturing a young child, the way it changes your brain is that there's a lot more communication between the left and right hemispheres. And so we're much more able to utilize these techniques more quickly and successfully sometimes than even men can, who don't have that advantage of the communication that we do between our two hemispheres. So it actually is something that we can access really easily once we start to. And it really just means that when you move your body, your emotions literally set the energetic frequency of your body. So your body is always changing vibrations and the people around you are always matching it, and you're always matching theirs.
I love that on Steve Harvey's show, you said, be responsible for the energy that you walk into the room with. And I've gotten much better at that. I can ground myself, or I can use some of the techniques in your book. Like, I love how you say, you know, what way is this experience for me? I had an experience with that earlier this week where my daughter is, we were in New York for a week and now she's sick for a week. And I was like, I was really in an ego driven state of like how I needed to read your book to let go of my ego. I was like, my daughter is sick and it's ruining everything. And I was like, how is this for me? Okay, well, I don't get to work as hard on the podcast, but it's been months since I've been able to like go on a walk with Sabrina and like make lunch with her, because usually we'll go on errands or we'll have play dates or we'll do other stuff. But because she's sick and has to stay home, we can have like these quiet moments that we haven't been able to have. Yeah. And that actually I'm practicing what you're preaching rather than just like taking notes on it. And that's how it the experiences for
me. That's how it sinks in. And the other thing to remember, and I do talk about this a lot, is that there's nothing wrong with ego. I love how one of my favorite authors is Anita Morjani. She wrote, her first book was Dying to Be Me. It's awesome. And she just wrote a new book, something, I can't remember the title, but something like What If Heaven Is Here and Now. It's about how really she believes that we create our own heaven and hell now, you know, and one of the metaphors she used, which I absolutely love, is she talks about how when we're born, you know, we come in, and I talk about this too in the book, we come in as these pure, you know, unadulterated love beings. And then it gets conditioned into us, partly because of our survival. We're like even more than human tuning forks. We're human sonars when we're babies. We're picking up everything from our environment and matching it because it's key to our survival. And there are all of these unconscious communications going on between caregivers and babies that sort of shift and change our frequency over time. But what she was saying is that we're born with, you know, if you imagine like two dials, one is ego and one is consciousness, and both are turned up to 10. But what happens to some of us is that our ego stays up, you know, your ego meaning the reason your ego is good is that it teaches, you know, it determines your likes and dislikes. It helps you advocate for yourself. It alerts you when something's not serving you. It motivates you. It helps you see a separation, which is often necessary between yourself and someone else. It helps you not be a doormat. You know, there are lots of ways that your ego serves you. Your consciousness is your awareness of the bigger picture, your connection to that loving place inside you, your memory of who you really are as a divine being connected to that universal energy that connects everyone. And that starts to be turned down when parents, you know, tell their kids that imaginary friend isn't real, or, you know, diminishes them for some of their, what we would call magical thinking, which Anita Morjani argues is not really magical, but real, you know, that we sort of accidentally condition out this connection to their consciousness. So as we grow, and this I know happens to most of us who are now adults, you know, the consciousness knob is turned down lower than the ego knob. And the key is in having both turned all the way up, or at least even.
That's amazing. How do I hold my energetic state regardless of negative surroundings, though? Like, I can ground myself. I can be more aware when I'm by myself. I can turn things, or I can flip it. I can walk into a room with great energy. But I still have that child part of me that is so mirroring the people around me that it's very easy for me to get sucked in. I mean, this has been like a constant theme in my life. Like, how do I have boundaries? Like, how do I create like a Glinda bubble so that I'm not sort of taking on everybody else's
energetic condom?
Oh, mine is, hi, Dr. Berman, it's Bridget. Mine is my anxiety shield. That's what I call it.
Right. Yeah, how do I get your anxiety shield? Can I order that on Amazon, Bridget?
Yeah, wouldn't that be great? You know, that's the work. To me, that's the work. And what I try to remember is that if you can stay in those states 51% of the time, your life will drastically change for the better, and your relationships with your kids will drastically change for the better. And it's really practice and the muscle, exercising that muscle of moving into what I call home frequency. Home frequency is our natural state. And so that's why I created the Time Love Map in my book, because it turns out that each emotional state we have has an energetic frequency. And it doesn't mean, like, hope frequency is really anything from optimism up. Optimism, hopefulness, courageousness, curiosity, love, forgiveness. You know, those kinds of emotional states are all high home frequency, where more of what you want in your relationships are going to happen, and people will match you there. So if you want your partner to show up in a different way, if you want your kids to show up in a different way, if you want to calm your kids down, if you want them to move, if one of them to sleep, whatever it is, if you hold those states, everything in your life will go better. But the way that you get good at holding those states in the midst of things that make you want to constrict is two things to remember. One is that our energy is always expanding and constricting. So think of, you know, the expansion as home frequency, and the constriction is when you move into what I call ego frequency, where it's frustration, anger, guilt, shame, doubt, you know, those sorts of judgment, you know, those sorts of spaces are more constrictive, but they're okay. It's just about practicing how to move in and out of them. And actually, on my website, I have some guided meditations, one in particular that shows you how to create a biofeedback system for yourself, where it becomes really easy to shift back to home frequency when you're getting triggered. And basically what you do is, and I can, you know, I can walk you through this as we move along to show you just an example of how to move your body into home frequency. But you move your body into home frequency with your thoughts, and then you move to a thought that causes you constriction, doubt, anger, fear, frustration. And then you move your body back into home frequency. And then you move back to constriction. And then back to home frequency. And your body starts to kind of get used to, and your mind-body connection into moving into those different states. You learn to see what it feels like in your body. So now if I'm going into a meeting, I don't have to have all of these grounding thoughts to like move myself into home frequency. I can just move myself into that just automatically because my body knows how to do it now.
I trained with Peter Levine's somatic experiencing, and one of the best tools I got from that, I've only done the first year, it's like a 3-year program, but one of the best tools was this idea of like seeing things in blue and red when people are telling you about their experiences, and this idea that if you go to, you start in blue, like someone's good experience, like basically kind of what you're saying, I think, because you start in blue and then they can dip into the red. But then you want them to go back to blue because otherwise they shut down and you can't integrate the experience. And and that has been so helpful for me because I'll, you know, also in interviews, because you know that as an interviewer that the guest, you know, they'll share something, but it's very clear energetically when they've shut off, like you've gone too far. And so you try to, you go back into like, what are the good experiences? And I think that that's so healing. And it's really cool that you've found this other way of expressing that.
Yeah. And what can I say? I mean, I use it in my, my relation with my husband. That's how I really knew I was onto something. And I share this in the book because he is so smart and such a good, like, I can't win an argument with him if I try. And he's, I mean, and I can win an argument with just about anyone, you know, maybe not about, you know, things I don't know about, but, you know, relationship stuff or who was right, who was wrong, you know, that kind of thing.
I'm very good at winning that one.
And when he was, I just convinced them they were wrong, you know.
It's the same thing, isn't it, Dr. Berman?
You and Bridget, with your backgrounds in psychology, you guys are, you're mind masters. Yeah. I got to be careful with both of you.
So I remember I was sitting outside with him and he was mad at me about something. I did something to upset him and he was lighting into me and I was like thinking to myself, you are so off base, you know, and I was doing what I would typically do, which is listen to respond, not a healthy way to argue in your relationship, right? You got to really listen. So I was already starting to think of my responses and how to tell him he's totally off base and whatever else. And instead I was like, oh yeah, wait, quantum love. And, you know, because I've just been playing with this idea. And so I went into home frequency and I looked at him where normally I'd look at him with, even if I didn't show it, with frustration or even disdain if he was being really, you know, if I was really judging him or in a judgmental place. But at that moment I looked at him and I was like, okay, this is another human being who's obviously hurting, who I love. And this is a blip in the spring, you know, in the whole picture of our relationship. And, you know, I need to hold him with love and compassion and appreciation. And I was just thinking all those things in my head rather than thinking what my comeback was going to be. And this man who this never happens to ever lost his train of thought. As I moved into home frequency and held it, he just naturally matched it, lost his angry train of thought, shoulders relaxed, sat down next to me, you know, I laid my head on his shoulder and like we had the rest of the conversation, but it was over in an instant. It was not a big deal anymore, you know, and that's when I knew that something real was happening. And then I started using it with my kids, like even now, and it's fun to teach your kids about this. My kids know all about quantum love. And so, you know, I was in the swimming pool this summer with my now 11-year-old. And we were like in this little hot tub and we were resting. There was a bubble board on, but it was hot. And his feet were still touching my feet. We were both just sort of floating there. And I said, hey, what would happen if we both went into like home frequency right now? I wonder if the water would conduct it back and forth. And we laid there like that. I don't know. It must have been 10 minutes. This, you know, ADD kid who never sits still, totally silent. And he could totally feel it. Like he talks about it all the time. When we were cuddling the other day and my husband came in and hopped on the bed with us and was cuddling Jess and said, I'm going to go into home frequency, you know, and he just sort of, and so it really works. I can get him to go to sleep like that. I just have to move into that open heart state while I lie in bed with him and imagine no barrier between us, that we're not separate. And he will immediately match me. And that's what happens in the research. Our heart rate synchronizes, our breathing synchronizes, our mood synchronizes. So when you're, instead of just matching everyone around you, when you start to consciously direct your energy and your perception to be in these higher frequency states, everything starts to change for the better.
Yeah, it's interesting because this last or 2 weeks ago, I had sort of the negative version of this experience, Dr. Berman, which was I went to – I'm expecting my second child, so I'm almost 30 weeks pregnant, and I went to a prenatal yoga class, Babies Welcome, and there were many, many babies there, and it was the day after – the election, and the class was mostly made up of people who were exclusively who were unhappy with the result. And there was some discussion of it before class started and where everyone was at emotionally. And every baby started to cry in the class. And nobody, everyone was using their yoga voices. Nobody, you know, and speaking sort of very abstractly about the experience. And there wasn't a baby there who was older than 4 months, but it was... It was really remarkable, and we all commented on it.
Yeah, they're little barometers of what's going on.
They are such little barometers. Okay, we're going to talk so much more about this, and we're also going to talk about sex when we come back after a word from our sponsor. This holiday, turn to Seedling for creative gifts for all the kids on your list. Everything your child needs is included in each kit. I mean, which is such a relief to me. They are adorable, creative, and fun, and they're also convenient to us. Okay, last weekend, we opened the Design Your Own Bird Wings kit, and this week, we're moving on up. We're doing Make Your Own Snow Globe and Design Your Own Superhero Mask. Seedling.com also has one of the best websites I've ever been on. It's so easy to figure out the crafts by age group. Just go to Seedling.com to check out their packaging. I think it's also important to note that each child has a unique experience because Seedling doesn't provide the same step-by-step instructions you'll find with other products. So there are no rules. There's just exploration. And it's high-quality play. The materials meet the highest standards, so every creation can be played with again and again. Go explore the newest and best-selling collections for yourself. Or for awesome gifts, just go to seedling.com and use the code ATOMIC for $10 off a $30 purchase or more. That's seedling.com, code ATOMIC, Seedling, growing creative kids. And now back to our interview with Dr. Laura Berman.
I have come to notice that and really believe and find it to be true every time that when my kids start acting out, especially at home, they're reflecting something in the energy going on in me or my husband or between us that we're not even conscious of. And they are unbelievable in trainers. I mean, it's part of their survival. Kids have, babies and children have to entrain in order to get you to stick around and take care of them. You know, they have to match you. And they're not selective about how they match you. So if you're in a good place, they're going to match you there. If you're in a bad place, they're going to match you there. And part of the key to this is always questioning your stories and your assumptions and committing to really trying to always attach to a better feeling story. You know, women today, I like to call, you know, I consider myself a recovering alpha woman.
I always say recovering perfectionist, and I got so excited when I saw that you wrote that.
And I'm also a recovering type A perfectionist as well. They often go hand in hand.
That alpha thing.
But, you know, this idea of the women of our generation who were raised by women who helped spearhead the women's movement and who really had that energy of no one controls you, always be independent, always control everything, you know, that we tend to be angry a lot. And even if we don't show it, we're frustrated, we're tight, we're scared, we're tense. You know, and then we don't understand why everyone else around us isn't towing the line.
Right.
And we get scared that if we move into these better feeling beliefs, and this was a big hurdle for me, I write about this in the book as well, that for me, I imagined that if I, especially with my husband, if I started holding a more positive belief about him or stories about him, when in the past it would have been something that raised my hackles or I saw as unfair. You know, obviously I'm not talking about anything abusive or anything that really was diminishing to me or my power, but stupid things that I normally would have made a battle of wills, unconsciously, of course. When I sort of surrender more to the better feeling thought, I started to realize that I was using that tightness and control as a way to protect myself from being controlled. And I thought, okay, I'll just, you know, I unconsciously thought I'll just control everything. That way no one will control me. But it wasn't creating the results I wanted. And as I started to surrender more and try on more better feeling beliefs, I started to think, well, maybe I'm kidding myself. Maybe I'm just coming up with ways to justify kowtowing to him. Maybe, you know, this really isn't. And what I realized is that I think most women of our generation, the only model of power we had was a masculine model, which is very much force, fix, manage, and control, you know? And there is another kind of power that is so much better than that, found in quantum love. Like, it is serious power. And I can get anyone in my house to do pretty much anything I want without saying a word.
Oh, and this idea that it comes from control and how we kind of put that on our spouses, so many of our listeners are in the first year of motherhood, and they really want to murder their partner. And this is helpful. What would you say to that mom who's like, I just want to kill him or her? Like, I'm putting it all on my spouse. Like, everything they do is frustrating me.
Yeah.
Can you give us some spiritual salve?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things to keep in mind. One is that certainly if you're breastfeeding, but 6 months to a year, until 6 months to a year after you stop breastfeeding, your body is in a hormonal hoedown. And, you know, there is a lot going on in there that is going to make you anxious, angry, irritable,
sleep deprived,
low threshold for frustration. Add that with sleep deprivation. Add that to the anxiety, especially if you're a first time mom, of like this 24-hour need machine that I have to keep safe and I have to take to the right. And then all of our type A stuff kicks in. And I was certainly this way with my first son. You know, every mommy and me group that I should go to, and playing Beethoven so he could be good in math, and, you know, taking him to the Chinese language boo boo bear class or whatever else. You know, I was like taking him to a million things a day, and, you know, the sleep Nazi, my husband would call me, because I was like so uptight to get everything right. And in reality, I think that comes from an extremely loving place, because you're trying to do right by your kids, by your baby, you know, but it also is harmful. It's harmful to us, and it's harmful to the connection. And what I have learned now, you know, after 20 years of being a parent, is that what they need more than anything else, other than food, clothing, you know, shelter, bathing, health stuff, they need a deep connection to themselves and to you. They have to be resilient. They have to always know who they are inside, and they have to feel valued and connected. And the way they get there is not with a million different to-dos, you know, on your errand list or on your after-school list and all the different after-school scheduled stuff or preschool scheduled stuff. What they need is just relaxed play with you, child-centered play, connection. And the reason that I think we get so angry at our husbands or fathers of the children is because they weren't raised to be the perfectionists in this way that we were. And so they don't hold these things so tightly. And we get frustrated when they, for all intents and purposes, are not as uptight as we are, you know, when they're not willing to do
the to-do list
or when they're not willing. I mean, I came home once, and it can harm your relationship. I came home once when my two youngest were babies, and my husband was giving them a bath. Well, they weren't babies. I guess they were toddlers, because I had just gotten them these new underwear. It was like when they were first starting to wear underwear, and I hadn't washed them yet, so I wasn't planning on letting them use them. And I was the kind of mother, you know, you're going to put on these pajamas after they take the bath, and you're going to bathe them in this lavender oil and massage them afterwards. You know, I was doing all that stuff. And I come home, and my husband is giving them a bath in their new underwear. And I was like, okay, first of all, their underwear aren't washed yet. Second of all, like, why are you giving them? You know, I started to go into all that in my head. And then I was like, no, I want him to help. And now there's all this research coming out about babies in particular who have a lot of time with their fathers, are better academically,
better self-esteem, better at math and science. It's really interesting. It affects their brain positively to spend that time. And so I decided in that moment, I'm no longer going to attach to a story about how that my way of parenting or dealing with the kids is better than his. And so what if they're taking a bath in their underwear? He'll take them off. I'll squeeze them out and put them in the laundry. They'll still get their butts clean. Like, who cares?
Right.
And I just let it go. And I started to just let him do what he wanted to do with the kids, as long as it wasn't stupid, dangerous,
right.
Stupid, you know? And everything got better. So I think part of the reason that men shy away from helping as much as we want them to help is because they're terrified and everything they do is wrong. And then instead of appreciation, they get criticism when they're done. And that's not a big motivator. And the other thing is that they never lose unless they have low desire, but they rarely lose their desire. And so when that baby is born, they feel abandoned because now there's this 24-hour need machine between the two of you and you're not as sexually available to them as you were before. And that's the means by which men achieve that emotional closeness that women get through kissing, cuddling, talking, being together. Men get through the physical act of sex. So when she's postpartum and not that into it, even 6 weeks out, and nothing feels in the same place, and she's too tired.
And she's overtouched.
And she's overtouched. You know, why can't he understand? He feels really shut out. It would be the equivalent of him refusing to hold your hand or cuddle you or kiss you or tell you he loved you. You know, it really feels painful. And so I think a lot of men shut down at that point, and it's really hard to reconnect after that.
Because who wants to have sex with that person? It's kind of a negative feedback loop.
Yeah. And the irony is that for women, the number one inspiration in relationships for us to want to have sex is the emotional connection we feel to the guy we're going to have sex with.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've withheld sex and aren't available emotionally, you're not showing him any appreciation, he just experiences you as someone critical, angry, and shut down from him, he's going to withdraw from the relationship. And then as he withdraws from the relationship, you get angry at him even more. You feel less connected to him and that much less inspired to be sexual. So it's really important not to abandon that piece of the relationship. Even when you're tired, and women will discover this as the kids get older, even when you're tired, even when you'd rather be watching Downton Abbey, even when you'd rather be, you know, doing something else on your to-do list, once you start to get busy with him, you enjoy it. And you think afterwards, oh, I should do this more often, you know? So it's just about really putting your attention on sourcing your desire for your mate from a place other than spontaneous horniness, which goes away when you have a baby.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be from a place of wanting to nurture the relationship and love him and feel his love in return and continue to build that foundation, which is crucial to the success of that little baby's life.
And I think when we let go of some of that control as well, that helps. Because I know for me, it's also about not wanting to let my guard down, you know, like I trust my husband fully and I adore him and we have a wonderful connection. But for me, sometimes I'm like, I don't want to get out of my type A drive. I'm afraid I won't be able to like pick myself back up again afterwards. Like it's hard to.
Everything will go. Well, it's the equivalent of someone who won't let themselves feel their feelings.
Yeah.
Because they imagine that once I feel the sadness, I will drown in it. I'll never stop crying. It will overwhelm me, which isn't true. And it's the same thing with control. We think if we let go of one thing, then everything in life is going to go to hell. And, you know, that's not true. And it's really important from a parenting perspective. I think that the best parents have enough type A to be relatively organized, but that's where it ends, because your kids are going to act in ways that mortify you. They're going to do things in school that like it's hard to face. I mean, they're going to have learning issues or ADD issues or anxiety or frustrations or hard times, or they're not going to do well on their tests. And if you get stuck in that system of believing that you're responsible for their success, rather than they are these little souls that have chosen you as their parents, and a long time, you know, before you were born or when you were a soul, you guys chose each other. And you said, okay, this is what we're going to do. You're going to come in and you're going to trigger me around X, Y, or Z. Mm-hmm. So I can work on being more open-hearted, or I can work on being more forgiving because that's what I want to do in this life. And you're going to work on your thing, and we're going to be comrades in that. And when you start to see your children as their own little beings that you are guiding and shepherding, rather than controlling out of fear of what might happen, then your relationship becomes really magical. And it, and you have to hold things lightly and play a really long game with kids. And I used to have, you know, I talk about personas in my book, but I think I do talk about this in the book. I had this very strong, she still comes out sometimes, very strong dire mama persona. So when my kids were really small, you know, one of them wasn't sharing a toy, I was convinced that he was going to be selfish and no one was going to like him and he's going to become a Columbine shooter and addicted to drugs. You know, I could go all the way down the path because my kid didn't want to share his little toy with the other kid in the mommy and me group. And so those are all just stories that move us into ego frequency, where recently my 12-year-old did something really, that was my 11-year-old to my 12-year-old, did something he, you know, had ADD, wasn't getting treated, didn't want to take the medication. You know, I was letting that go for a little bit because I certainly wasn't going to pill push on him, right? And he was doing some really impulsive things, and he ended up finding, our phones are linked, so he has all of my pictures. He ended up finding a picture I'd forgotten to delete, which was of my his older brother, the 12-year-old sleeping on the bed with our dog. And I thought I had just gotten my son's face and dog, but there was a little mound of his cute little naked tushy in the picture. And I couldn't bring myself to delete it, not knowing or not remembering that my other son had access to those pictures. And impulsively, when my youngest son was really mad at his brother and not in control of his impulses, he decided to text that picture to the entire soccer team at his
school. Oh, my God.
Okay? Big deal. Big deal. So I didn't even know about it until the principal called me another parent on the soccer team had called him to tell him this was what was happening.
Sure, there was a picture of a nude child circulating.
Oh, my God. I mean, it was so bad. And so I took some deep breaths, you know, calmed myself down. We were talking to Jackson, the youngest one, he did this about this. We took away his phone for the foreseeable future. We were angry. We were upset with him. We made him, you know, sit down with his brother and tell him what he had done and take responsibility for that. We had him write an apology, you know, to his team. We did all of those things. But it was not with anger. And I also said to him during that time, listen, we're really disappointed with the choice you made. We also know that when you have time to think about the choices you're making, you always make the right choice. And so we know this was one of those times where you just weren't thinking. And we also know that you are an amazing guy and you are so kind and so compassionate that you couldn't have been in your right mind when you did this, because I know who you are and we love you and we're proud of you. And even if we're disappointed, we remember who you are.
Wow.
We remember who you are. And I think that is so, so important because it's so easy to move into those, you know, angry, punishing, scary ways that I was certainly raised
shaming.
That way.
Shaming, yeah.
Yeah, and that shame is so low frequency and it's so toxic and it doesn't inspire good behavior. Fear and shame does not inspire good decisions later in life. In the short term, it may make them toe the line, but as soon as they reach adolescence and into adulthood, that will lead them to make the worst choices possible, not only ones that put their lives at risk, put their hearts at risk.
Yeah. I'm sure you have to go in a moment. But speaking of shame, I have definitely coupled sex with shame. It's not a great place to be. Do you have any advice for how I can fix this for myself? But also, like, how do I raise a sexually healthy daughter? And, and like, these toddlers are always, you know, a lot of them touch themselves. So, like, how do you handle masturbation?
Let them touch. Yeah. I mean, they're all going to touch themselves. They do it to soothe themselves. They're not doing it because they're getting like, woohoo, I want to have sex. And so what I would say, what I would, you know, recommend, and what I said to my own kids is, listen, I know that feels great. And it's a part of your body that you should love and celebrate, but it is also your private part. So that means that when you touch it or play with it, it's got to be in private. You know, you can't do it when company's over. You can't do it at your, you know, play
preschool
group. You got to do it when you're in private. And, you know, they would say, okay, mommy, I'm going in my room now to play with myself. And they'd close the door and, you know, go do it. And that was fine. So, but I wrote a book called Talking to Your Kids About Sex, which really takes you through conversation starters and what needs to be covered at every phase of development. But the main thing is that you want to be their primary source of information and not holding their sexuality in shame. Just like kids or babies are born pure love, they're also born sexual beings, not ready to have sex, but sensual sexual beings. And the best thing you can do for your marriage and for them is to get over those inhibitions that so many of us were raised with. And there are lots of ways to do that. Actually, I'm working on a proposal for my next book, which is Quantum Sex. But one of the best ways of addressing the stories that you have about sex is to make a list of everything that, you know, you pick the title, a nice girl, a respectable woman, a good person, whatever it is, would and wouldn't do sexually, especially wouldn't do, you know, and stories about sex. So if I, you know, have a want sex, I'm a slut, you know, or that oral sex is dirty, whatever it is, masturbation is evil. Whatever those stories were that you kind of carry with you, or even not even that you carry with you, that you were told overtly or indirectly growing up. And then in the next column, you write where that came from. You know, oh, that came when my Aunt Mary caught me masturbating and slapped my hand away and said that that made me a slut. Or that came when, you know, the sister in my Catholic school told us, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so you write it in that in the second column. And then you ground yourself, you open your heart, you move into home frequency, and you look at the list and you say, okay, which ones, as the woman I am now, the married woman to a man I love who has these children, who, you know, really wants to live in love and light, which ones of these do I really still believe in? And some of them might still be true for you, and that's okay. But then what starts to happen is the ones you want to release, the next time you start to have that thought, you think, oh yeah, that's just Sister Mary Margaret from Catholic school. I don't believe in that anymore. And you start to separate yourself from your beliefs, and that's the first step in changing that.
That's excellent advice. Thank you so much, Dr. Berman. We really, really appreciate it.
It was fun talking to you guys.
Okay, everybody, don't forget to subscribe. Go to itunes.com/atomicmoms or go on your iPhone, find that podcast app, and then just type in Atomic Moms and press search and then press subscribe and then press the 5-star review. You're amazing. Okay, until next week, trust in your goodness, live out your greatness, rock on, Atomic Moms.